Okay, so here we are. We're going to go ahead and pick up at page 2. We had read the first paragraph, and the first paragraph ends with, "It is our responsibility to try to discern that sense." And then it has footnote 6, which we're not going to deal with that. So this is where we're going to pick it up. This is where we ended last week. So here we are, the next paragraph. "It is these verses, more than anything else in the gospel, that have fostered the impression that Matthew took a very conservative line on legal observance, believing that the Christian disciple was bound to continue to obey all the commandments of the Torah just as much as, or indeed more meticulously than, those Jews who had not followed Yeshua." And there is footnote 7 there, and we will get to it in a minute, but we got to go back and break this up because there's a lot of stuff in this sentence. So let's start off right at the beginning. "It is these verses, more than anything else in the gospel, that have fostered the impression that Matthew took a very conservative line on legal observance." What in the world is that? So Matthew just decides, you know what? I think I am going to take a conservative line on legal observance and write my testimony of what I've seen with the agenda that we need to keep the law. Really? Is that where we are today? Oh, my goodness. All right, so that's what I take away from the first part of that sentence, that Matthew took a very conservative line on legal observance as though there was an option. Well, you know, I guess we could skip a few laws. That would be cool. But he didn't take that line. No, he didn't take that line. He took a very conservative line on legal observance. This is crazy. This is absolutely ludicrous, this type of comment. Oh, gets me so upset, and I read it all the time. All right, back to normal. Continuing, "Matthew took a very conservative line on legal observance, believing that the Christian disciple..." Christian disciple? There was no Christian disciples in the first century. Ah, you're like, wait a minute, what are you saying? You'll have to stay tuned, because I'll be addressing it. Indeed, I will. Probably next week. "Believing that the Christian disciple..." How about the Jew of the sect of the Nazarenes was bound to continue to obey all the commandments of the Torah? What did James, that's Yaakov, James for the us KJV people, Acts 21, I think it's verse 20, or around that area, talking to Paul, said, "Tens of thousands of Jews here in Judea," which, of course, Paul referenced in 1 Thessalonians 2:14. I already covered that. "And they are all zealous for the Torah." That means that instead of believing that the Christian disciple, believing that the Jewish disciples of Yeshua, who remained Jewish and were part of the sect of the Nazarenes, Yeshua Judaism, Matthew was making it clear that they're bound to continue to obey all the commandments of the Torah because Yeshua said it. That's the reality of the situation. Either Yeshua said it or he didn't say it. And all of these disciples who wrote their memoirs are either a bunch of liars or they're telling the truth. And so, you know, as an audience, we get to choose. We can say, nah, I think he was just lying through his teeth. But I believe the rest of what he said, really. Oh, my goodness. Okay, I need to calm down here. I got a long way to go. "Matthew took a very conservative line on legal observance." No, he didn't. "Believing that the Christian disciple," there weren't any, "was bound to continue to obey all the commandments of the Torah just as much as, or indeed more meticulously than, those Jews who had not followed Yeshua." We're all following Torah. This is what it is. This is what was happening in the first century. All the sects were following Torah. Were there differences in interpretation? Yes, there were. This is not a shock. This is well-established fact. There were differences in interpretation. But it was still the Torah written by Moses, however you want to call it and phrase it and all that other stuff. Interpretations differed here and there, but it was still the Torah. And in the passage in verse 19, which could be exactly what he's specifically referring to, but that would be jumping ahead because he hasn't got to 17 yet. But let's just pretend he is saying these verses. So he maybe 17 through 20, since that's the section we're covering. But whatever it is, it's very clear that 19 is talking about keeping this and being very meticulous in keeping it. So you've got two sets of people. He calls one set Christian disciple and the others Jews who did not follow Yeshua. The reality, instead of the false narrative, is those Jews who followed Yeshua and those Jews who did not follow Yeshua. And then eventually the Gentiles came in, but they were still coming into the commonwealth of Israel. You can read that in Ephesians 2:11. So I feel like that what is going on here in this paragraph could be misleading to some people. That's how it's striking me. All right, so 19 and 20, and 20 also is talking about the scribes and the Pharisees, and the believers need to do better as far as their behavior. We discussed that in the first fruit section. He's kind of like saying that, than the Jews who did not follow Yeshua. So there's going to be some Jews who are not going to follow him. We already talked about that, and we'll talk about it again. But they were still following Torah, but they would just had different masters, different interpreters, which ended up equaling different behavior. So there's a lot to that. Let me finish the last sentence of this first paragraph we're covering today. Verses 18 and 19 taking on their own can certainly give that impression. Personally to me, I think it's verses 19 and 20. 18 only talks about how long Torah is going to last. 19 is talking about anyone who sets aside one of the smallest commandments and teaches others to disregard them. And then 20 says, need to do better than scribes and Pharisees. So I really think it should say verses 19 and 20. Taken on their own can certainly give that impression that all of the believing Jews and incoming Gentiles were bound to continue to obey all the commandments of Torah. Not the oral tradition, but the instructions. Now, let's keep going. Next paragraph. This is the last paragraph on page 2. The footnotes take half the page. Here we go. If that is what Matthew intended. All right, so now let's go back again. Is Matthew in charge? Yeshua lives his life. He does the miracles. He teaches. He accomplishes all the things that he was sent to accomplish. And so at the end, then God calls Matthew and says, you know, just write whatever you want. Listen, if you think that they need to keep the command, then you should write that. Yeah. But if you don't think they should keep, don't write that. Is that what God did after the ascension of Yeshua? I don't think so. I'm having a real problem with that. I'm having a real problem with that. Same paragraph. I know it takes a long time for me to get through a paragraph because I got so much to say. But anyway, if that is what Matthew intended, the interpreter, that's us. We're the interpreters. We are a group of interpreters. The interpreter must face the fact. Ooh, face the fact. You're going to tell me a piece of information that you've declared to be a fact. I wonder if I'll declare that to be a fact too. Will I concur with you, Mr. Scholar? Let's see. If that is what Matthew intended, the interpreter must face the fact that this teaching is out of step with the overall thrust of New Testament Christianity. Whoa, wait, whoa. There ain't no New Testament Christianity. You see? See what I'm saying? You see what I'm saying? I'll tell you what. All right, here we go. If that is what Matthew intended, the interpreter must face the fact that this teaching is out of step with the overall thrust of New Testament Christianity as interpreted by a bunch of people who rejected the instructions of God and wanted to create their own religion called Christianity, starting in the 2nd century and pouring concrete in the 4th century. Yeah, this is all coming down the road. Let me be perfectly clear. This is all coming down the road. And with the almost universal consensus of Christians ever since. Yeah, well, there were Christians in the 2nd century. They're written about. Different people referred to that. They used it in the Greek, other languages. I totally agree with you. The second half of that part is true. So let's skip over the first part so that we can get a clear look at what he's saying. If that is what Matthew intended, that the interpreter must face the fact that this teaching is out of step with the almost universal consensus of Christians ever since the first century. That's absolutely true. Yeah. But I'm not concerned about what took place in the second century yet. I'm not concerned about what took place in the third century yet. I'm not concerned about what took place in the fourth century, the fifth century yet. I'm dealing with the first century. And we're going to get our facts straight. And listen, don't listen to me. I'm going to present the evidence by Protestant Christian scholars who are archaeologists who have done the work, and they're going to tell you what they found and didn't find. It's not me. I'm just the reporter. I'm just bringing you the evidence so that you can examine it, because that's what we're supposed to do. Micah 6:8, judge justly. Well, you diligently inquire the information that is available, and then you judge it. So I'm going to be presenting the information. You will be the judge. Yes. Okay. Here we go. Continuing. I haven't even finished the sentence yet, by the way, so I'm starting over again. If that is what Matthew intended, the interpreter must face the fact that this teaching is out of step with the overall thrust of New Testament Christianity and with the almost universal consensus of Christians ever since, at least with regard to the more ceremonial aspects of the Old Testament law, particularly its sacrificial provisions. And then there's footnote 8, which we're not going to deal with, but I do want to deal with footnote 7. So let me pick through here. In the previous paragraph, it said, the disciple was bound to continue to obey all the commandments of the Torah just as much as, or indeed more meticulously than, those Jews who had not followed Yeshua. The footnote says, this view, which was once the dominant interpretation, that's loaded, is expressed more recently by, and then they give the professor's name, it looks like Moore Lang, who concludes that, and then this scholar, this author of this commentary is going to give their, it's in quotes here, for Matthew, the law in its entirety remains a valid and authoritative expression of the will of God for the Christian community. Christian's wrong, but we'll just let that go for this moment. And all of life is viewed from this perspective. On pages 42 to 47, he compares Matthew with Paul and concludes that Matthew's viewpoint is closer to that of traditional Judaism, while Paul's represents a more radical break with it. That's not true either. And we will get there. But obviously, we're not going to get there today. Not the way I'm ranting. So, okay, so going back to the second paragraph that we read, he's kind of like doing a narrowing. It's not like narrowing your search down. You're looking for vanity, but now you want one that has, it's 37 inches wide, so you narrow it down, that type of thing. So his narrowing down is the more ceremonial aspects of the Old Testament law, particularly its sacrificial provisions. Now, here's the thing, and listen, I don't have any problem with footnote 8, and you have it in the text that's available from our website, as I repeat over and over again in these presentations. So I'm not disagreeing with what he says in 8. I'm actually agreeing, because people do use that theory, and the theory has no basis. As he says, it cannot be traced back earlier than the Middle Ages, so you know that's bogus. But my point is, the way he's wording this concerns me, and I'll tell you why. He says, at least with regard to the more ceremonial aspects of the Old Testament law, particularly its sacrificial provisions. But wait a minute. That whole thing, the Moedim, which is the feast, the biblical calendar that was established in Genesis 1:14 and then was executed in more detail in Leviticus 23. Of course, we have Passover in Exodus, early Exodus, maybe 12. So that's a part. Then this Exodus 25:9-40 says, build it according to the pattern. And we already went over Ephesians 3, where it talks about these things were conceived before the ages were created. And then Hebrews, which he talks about, because the next sentence is going to say the letter to the Hebrews. Hebrews talks about in chapter 9, which we did cover, that these things were done in the heavenly temple. there were certain things done on the earth, but this was all a picture. This was all a parable. It's kind of like goat 2 in Leviticus 16:21. It is a type. So we need to understand that the sacrificial provisions were a type. Hebrews really beats this dead horse. I mean, it's really over the top. But I'm okay with it because he's trying to make a point. Apparently, some people were having some issues thinking that the sacrifice of bulls and goats actually took away sin, which in chapter 10, he says that never happened. Verse 1 is talking about, so it contains a shadow. Colossians 2:16-17 says the festivals, new moons, and Sabbaths are foreshadowing that which is to come. Okay, I've got that. So we need to put things in place. If you are reading about the millennial kingdom, both like in Revelation and some other places, including talking about our inheritance, and then you go back to the prophets, it's a whole lot there, especially Ezekiel 40-something, for several chapters. Isaiah has a lot to say about it too. You will see that it talks about a millennial kingdom in which the temple is going to be rebuilt and all the sacrifices and stuff are going to take place again. We don't have the temple as I'm saying this message right now, but that it's all coming back into play. So this is not about we're doing away with it now and then we're going to bring it back again. No, the temple was destroyed. We can't do it. But it was never done away with. You just can't execute it right now. So the way he writes his next sentence, listen to this next sentence. The letter to the Hebrews is clear that these can have no further place after the one perfect sacrifice has been offered by Christ. But think about it. Yes, we know that the perfect sacrifice was offered by Christ. That has no impact whatsoever on the type. I don't know why people get this mixed up. It has nothing to do with the type. The type is for us. It's a way to see and understand. It's going to take place in the millennial kingdom. If I'm understanding the prophets and Revelation and some of those other things, some of those other sections of Scripture, it's going to take place again. It's going to be executed according to Torah. There's a couple of adjustments, but that's only because of the situation. So it was never done away with. I mean, you could go to Zechariah 14. And what does it say? After all this stuff has happened, then those who enter into the millennial kingdom are going to have to observe tabernacles. And if they don't, they're going to be punished on the spot. What? I thought that was done away with. No, it wasn't done away with. You see, this is the false narrative that has been propagated on us for almost 2,000 years. And it's time that we pull the carpet out and expose everything that's been swept under it. And that's what we're doing. That's what this show does. And that's what this show is going to continue to do. But anyway, okay, so he writes this sentence, the letter to the Hebrews is clear that they can have no further place. They can't be a picture of the entire plan of redemption because the perfect sacrifice has been offered. That makes no sense. You are talking as though those things actually did something. And that's where my concern is. All right, so let's continue. We are now on page 3. Yes, I know that's exciting. We have moved so far. We have done... Well, we've done a paragraph and a half. Okay, so we're going to pick up the rest of that paragraph. All right, now look at this. Paul, while his attitude to the law provides scope for a rich variety of interpretations and doctrinal dissertations. This guy is an excellent writer. That is an impressive opening part of a sentence, and I agree with him. Okay. The rest of the sentence says, uses language about freedom from the law. Galatians 5:1-6. No, it doesn't. Wrong. Give me somebody. Anybody here got a red pen? I need to write era here because I'm going to cover this. And you're going to see that Galatians 5:1-6 has nothing to do about freedom from the law. Because when he uses the word law in the middle of this paragraph, he's talking about the entire Old Testament law. And that is so incredibly, completely wrong that I don't even know what else to say. All right, but I got to keep going because I have to cover this, okay? Paul uses language about freedom from the law, Galatians 5, as I just said, and he lists a few other passages, and then listen to what he says, which sits very uncomfortably with a view that Torah observance is unchanged since the coming of the Messiah. Yeah. But what if Torah observance was not changed, and that the interpretation of past centuries laid over into the first century, that's called anachronism, we'll cover that one day. What if that was the deception of the ages? Yikes. That would be a concern. But I got to finish this. I got to at least do two paragraphs in one show. Got to at least do two paragraphs in one show. So I need to finish reading this. There's one more sentence in this paragraph. All right, here we go. Under his and Peter's guidance, the New Testament church, which didn't exist, found it necessary to abandon the Old Testament food laws. Has anybody read Acts 15 yet? As binding on all Christians. I got to read it again because I keep interrupting myself. Under his and Peter's guidance, the New Testament church found it necessary to abandon the Old Testament food laws as binding on all Christians. You know what they quote for that? Acts 11, verses 2 through 10, where Peter has finished with his visit to Cornelius. He's gone back, I think, to Jerusalem. He's meeting with the gang there, and they're asking some questions, and he's giving answers. And this author's conclusion from that section, completely ignoring what Peter said, which is, wow, this has to do with God and the Gentiles coming into the Commonwealth of Israel. Nope, I'm throwing that out, says this commentator. Under his and Peter's guidance, the New Testament church found it necessary to abandon the Old Testament food laws as binding on all Christians, Acts 11, 2 through 10. But then he doesn't finish. He doesn't finish with Acts 11. He has one more verse there, Romans 14, 14. He actually, can you believe this? He actually uses Romans 14, 14 to make a case about the food laws not being binding. That is so unbelievable that I don't even know what else to say. I know this has been a tough show to listen to because there's just too much stuff here that's unbelievable. So I got just a little bit over a minute, so I'm going to see if I can wrap this up because I don't want to get too far. Hey, you know what? I'm looking here at the next sentence, though. I think I can get through the next sentence of paragraph 3, and we'll build on that. All right, so it says, but the view that Matthew regarded all Old Testament laws, presumably including the sacrificial and food laws, as still binding regulations for the conduct of Yeshua's disciples, not only runs counter to the rest of the New Testament and of subsequent Christian thinking, but also conflicts with clear pointers within his own gospel. And then he's going to go to Matthew 15, 11, which is also in Mark 7, 1 through 19. So you can see I'm going to have to stop reading his commentary because I've got to address Galatians 5, 1 through 6. I have to address Acts 11 through 2 through 10, and I have to address Romans 14, 14. And probably I'm going to start with Romans 14, 14 first because we have to understand the level of scholarship that this commentator is bringing to the text. And I think the best way to do that is by starting in Romans 14, 14. So this show is this particular segment is beginning to wind down. But in the second segment of this show, I'm going to come back to this paragraph and just cover it briefly. Then I'm going to take Romans 14, 14 on. And I'm going to go through that so that you yourself will be able to make the judgment of the level of scholarship and preparation this gentleman has made on writing a commentary on the book of Matthew and using Romans 14, 14 to support abandoning all Old Testament food laws. You will be shocked. All right, thank you. That's all I got. Welcome back to our second segment. We're going to be looking at a passage that has been mentioned by the author of the commentary that we are reviewing. This is the New International Commentary of the New Testament, and it is the version of the book of Matthew. We are focusing on Matthew 5 and the verses 17 through 20. That's where we're going to be picking this up. I'm going to read a little bit just to reset where we are and tell you the verse that we're going to be covering, and there's some associated verses with it. So there's a number of pieces here, but first let's just review and remember what the author of the commentary had to say. He is breaking down the pieces of verses 17 through 20, and he's making different comments here and there. And he is stating that it is our responsibility, us that are coming to this commentary and are attempting to understand what is being said, we need to understand Matthew's plan, what he was communicating. And he makes this point here, and I agree with him. Now, what is interesting is that in the middle of page 2, it says there are these verses here that foster the impression that Matthew took a very conservative line on legal observance, believing that the Christian disciple was bound to continue to obey all the commandments of the Torah. And we talked about that in the previous segment, so I'm not going to beat that dead horse anymore. But I do want to just cover a few of these sentences to make sure we know exactly where we are, so I can make sure that we know exactly where we're going. So the last paragraph on page 2, and by the way, as I have said before, you can download this because I've already prepared it for you. If this is what Matthew intended, the interpreter, that's us, must face the fact that this teaching is out of step with the overall thrust of New Testament Christianity. There is no such thing as New Testament Christianity. There is no such thing as New Testament Christianity, but we'll have to deal with that on another day. And then he continues that sentence with the almost universal consensus of Christians ever since. Yeah, that exists. I'm totally there. I totally agree with you. So we do have a problem, and we have to break it down step by step. We can't cover every single aspect, every single theological concept in 5 minutes and completely explore all avenues of that. Completely explore. Can't do it in 5 minutes. So you have to break it down over time. That's what we are doing. Today we're going to take a look at a verse and the associated verses with it and try to get a clearer picture of what the author's saying. So let me continue. We're now going over to his page 3, and we did this in the last segment. He's talking about some verses, and he mentions Galatians 5, 1 through 6, coming up in the next show. Acts 11, 2 through 10, I'll mention them today, but they're coming up in the next show. And then Romans 14, 14, that is what we're going to explore in great detail today. That is in the opening paragraph of page 3. Now, he continues with the concept that he established, as I just read on page 2. He says, but the view that Matthew regarded all Old Testament laws as still binding regulations for the conduct of Yeshua's disciples, not only runs counter to the rest of the New Testament, no, it doesn't, but you can force the New Testament to say what you want it to say, and there's a variety of ways to do that, and many have done it, and we're going to expose them on the show and today. Not only runs counter to the rest of the New Testament and of subsequent Christian thinking, that's true, also conflicts with clear pointers within his own gospel, 15:11. No, it doesn't. So each one of these we have to look at, we have to examine, and then we have to draw a conclusion, and which, of course, you, the audience, is going to be able to draw that conclusion. I drew mine a lot many years ago. I originally gave this presentation, or parts of this presentation, July of 2011. So this information has been out there. It's been around. It's been available for a long time. And so I'm just bringing it back up here so I can answer the question that was submitted to us, that I quoted a number of commentaries by Protestant Christians that support that the Torah is in place today for all believers. And then the question that followed was, well, what do we do with a commentary that doesn't support that? Well, here we are. This commentary does not support it, and we're going to address it. I'm going to stop there as far as reading from the New International Commentary of the New Testament, Book of Matthew, this section, Matthew 5. We have established what's been said and what their reference points are. And if you remember back to when I originally started this show, not today's show, but this show's in general, what is our job to do? If it's scholars reviewed, then we're responsible to find out who they quote, the context of the quote, how they're supporting their evidence, and that is exactly what we're going to do. And we're going to do that over and over again with everything that we look at, because that's just what we do. Now I'm going to move from that. I wanted to go to Romans 14:14 so we can read the verse. So I'm just going to read it from the KJV. It says, and I'm reading it straight out of the KJV, I know and am persuaded by the Lord Jesus that there is nothing unclean of itself, but to him that esteemeth anything to be unclean, to him it is unclean. I went to a website called BibleHub.com, and I looked up Romans 14:14, and there were 28 different translations. And you know how many of them had unclean? I don't know how many had unclean, but because some of them changed it from unclean to we can eat anything we want. So they had that type of thing going on. But of the ones that stayed with the underlying Greek language, supposedly, they used the word unclean. I would say the conclusion of the 28 is everything is good. You can eat anything you want. That would be the conclusion. Here is where the situation begins to get a little murky. If you move down to the next level, the Greek that underlines Romans 14:14, thinking back to the reading of the verse in English, the word unclean is mentioned 3 times. In that verse, the word unclean in the Greek isn't mentioned at all. It doesn't exist. Not only that, in the entire book of Romans, the word unclean does not exist. Yeah, how about that? Well, maybe Paul doesn't know how to use the word unclean. Yeah, that's possible, except that across all of his written literature, he uses the word unclean in the Greek 12 times. I've looked at all of them. The word here is the word common. Yeah. That's where we're going to start with the problem that exists. I want to take you to another passage where the word common and the word unclean both exist at the same time in that passage. And you know the passage well. It's Acts 10 and verse 14. This is Peter, and we have the net that comes down out of heaven. I'm going to read verse 14 from the KJV. It says, "But Peter said, not so, Lord, for I have never eaten anything that is common or unclean." Now here, the word common, the Greek word common, is translated as the English word common, and the Greek word unclean is translated as the English word unclean. But that's not what the translators chose to do in the 28 versions that I am referencing from Bible Hub, which you can look up BibleHub.com and then go to Romans 14:14. You'll be able to see that. They did not follow that passage. What they did was is that where it said common, they placed unclean. I'm going to ask a question. You can call me a conspiracy theorist, but if you want to make it a doctrine that the Old Testament food laws have been done away with, if you have a passage where it says common, but you translate it into English as unclean, then you just made your case, because now of all the English readers that are going to come after you and read your translation, they're going to see that there is nothing that is unclean anymore. And that's awesome. They're saying this is awesome. And the fact of the matter is you haven't translated it correctly. It's nothing is common. Nothing was common of itself, which is a Second Temple Judaic debate. So I want you to look here. What does Peter say? Not so, Lord. I have never eaten anything that is common or unclean. So we're talking about eating. It says eating. So this is about consuming, we could say consuming food, all right? I've never eaten anything that is common or unclean. So I went over and I wanted to check the NET Bible where they have their notes. And so I want to tell you, it's footnote 38. This is free online. You can get NET Bible. Here's what it says. Possibly, there is a subtle distinction in meaning between common and unclean here. I'll read that again. Possibly, there is a subtle distinction in meaning between common and unclean here. But according to Loanida 53.39, it is difficult to determine precise differences in meaning based on existing context. Really? Context is the key. This is Second Temple Judaism. This is a Jew that's operating within Yeshua Judaism who's going to visit a Gentile. Now, that's a big deal. That's a big deal. And we're going to look at a couple more verses with that so you can see how big a deal it is, at least in Peter's mind. The context is absolutely, positively an important piece. Now, I wanted to see exactly what this was talking about. So I ran over to Loanita Lexicon, and I pulled up 53.39, and I want to read you what it says. I have never eaten anything defiled and ritually unclean. That's how they translated. The word ritually is not in the text. The word defiled is not in the text. They're just putting stuff in there. Here's what they say. It is possible that there is some subtle distinction in meaning. So that's what the Net Bible was quoting, because they wanted to find something that would support making it not important, that it's two different things about food, common and unclean. They want to eliminate that. They go on in Loanita to say, there it is possible there is some subtle distinction in meaning, particularly on a connotative level. In other words, a level of which there's a second meaning. That is strange. I looked it up. It is difficult to determine the precise differences of meaning on the basis of existing context. If you put it back into Second Temple Judaism, it would be no problem at all, because common was an intra-Judaic debate between Pharisaic Judaisms and Yeshuic Judaism. And Paul, of course, is making a comment in Romans 14. We'll get back to that. This is how Loanita finalizes their statement. The two terms are probably, that's speculation, are probably used in Acts 10:14 primarily for the sake of emphasis. No, they're not. It's for the sake of contrast. He is bringing up the two things as part of the discussion, and it's going to continue. It's going to show up again. That's Loanita, and when you see it in the Net Bible, that's who they're quoting, and that's what's being said there. So they were looking for somebody that would support that. Now, I want to go back, before I return to Romans 14, I want to go back to Acts 10:14. Peter has just said, I've never eaten anything that is common or unclean. If we go to verse 15, look what it says. The voice spake unto him again the second time, what God hath cleansed, that call not thou common. That's interesting, isn't it? Don't call those people common. Now, we're going to look at one more verse, and that is verse 28 in Acts. And here it says, Peter's doing his sermon, and he says, you know how it's against the law for a man that's a Jew to keep company or come unto one of another nation. No, it's not. We discussed that. It's not against the law. It's against oral tradition. If you intertwine oral tradition and the written Torah and call them one law, then yeah, it's against that law. But the fact is that one of the things Yeshua came to do was unconnect the oral tradition from written law. So, and this is one of those things. It is not against written Torah for a Jew to go into a Gentile. Now, there's still stuff you got to deal with, but it's not against the law. So that was the first part. We dealt with that. But let's look at the second part. After all that has taken place, Peter says, God has shown me that I should not call any man common or unclean. Now, I went over to Net Bible Notes, and if you read, it's 76, they have defiled or ritually unclean. That's how they have translated the passage in their Net Bible. Then they have footnote 76, and it says the exact same thing at 10:14. Possibly there is a subtle distinction, blah, blah, blah. Requoting what Loanita said. But here's something interesting. Now, as they close out their commentary on that verse, they write, Peter sees the significance of his vision as not about food, but about open fellowship between Jewish Christians and Gentiles. But really, this is, since there were no Jewish Christians, all right, but about open fellowship between Jews who believe Yeshua is the Messiah and Gentiles. Because that part has been done away with. He has taken that part of the oral tradition out of what is required for obedience. So it's been settled. You'll see in the trial in chapter 11, in which this whole thing is brought up again. And I'm just bringing to your remembrance that the section 11.8 and 11.9, the author mentions this as his support for the Old Testament food laws being done away with. And he quotes that. And it's the same thing, common, unclean. So it's not on point. And we'll get to that. We'll get that. But first, I have to establish the problem, the main problem here, with Romans 14 and verse 14. Now, I've already stated that Paul's use, he uses the word, the Greek word unclean 12 times, and it's appropriately used, and he uses the word common 5 times, and 3 times is involving food. That's Romans 14, 14. So we need to take this back to where it starts, and that would be the book of Leviticus, chapter 5, verse 2, and that's where unclean shows up. And if you do a search, and when I did a search, I found 250 occurrences of the Hebrew word tami, which is unclean, 250. And here is my question for the audience. How many times was it translated into the Greek as common? The answer is zero. It's always translated into the Greek word unclean. It's never translated into common. So going back to the Lowell Nida lexicon, they say that it was primarily used for the sake of emphasis. Really? Well, that's interesting. Why wouldn't they use it in Torah writings or prophets? It's difficult to determine the precise differences of meaning on the basis of existing context. Why don't you go look at the context and see how it is used? You'll find the common's not used relating to food in the entire Tanakh because it wasn't created as a problem until the first century. There's your context again. See how these things circle around? So what we're going to do now, we're going to look at the history of translation. And I think this is something that you need to know. It will certainly simplify understanding. Wycliffe had the first English translation. And here's the surprising thing. When he translated Romans 14, 14, and you've got this, I've got the pictures, it's in the PDF, you can see it. You'll see that he translated it unclean, but we know that he and the other fellows that helped translate and create this English version, they used the Latin, and the Latin has common. And so you're going to see that in a minute. But now we're going to jump up from that century, Erasmus in 1519, so I can just be clear. And you can see that I have a picture of the text, and then I move to another picture of the text, and I want you to see how the Greek is in the left side and the Latin is in the right side. And you can see it's common and common. All right, so that part of it, the non-English part, is accurate on point. And then I can show you again, common, common, and common. All right, so now let's continue. Luther in 1522 does the German. And so you can see that he has 3 words there. Now, are those common or are those unclean? Well, let's go to the German Acts 10:14. You'll notice that it's common or unclean. So you can see that in the German. So going back a page to his German, he also has common. So Luther got that right. Then we do the Coverdale Bible in 1535, and you'll notice that all 3 of them is common. This is the English. It's in common. Then we go to the Matthews in 1535, and that section, they have common. So now we go to the Great Bible, 1539, they have common. Now we go to the Geneva Bible in 1557, but they put in unclean. Wow, that was shocking. Then we go over to chapter 10, verse 14, the section we just talked about with Peter. They have polluted and unclean. So they know. If you look at polluted in the picture there, you'll see the 2 parallel bars to the right side, vertical. Then you come over to the outside the column, and it'll say common. So they know. They knew, and it was wrong. So what happened in the Bishop's Bible that followed that one? Common got back in there. So you can see it there. And if you look over to the side there, you will see Matthew 15, which our commentary author has mentioned we're going to address. You'll notice Acts 10. We've already addressed that. And you'll notice Mark 7, and I'm going to mention that when we do the Matthew 15. He didn't mention it, but that's because he's the writer for the Matthew commentary. That's okay. So let's keep going. Now we're at the KJV 1611. Every Bible that's gotten it out of the Greek, so that eliminates Wycliffe, except one, has gotten it correct. It's common. So what does KJV have? KJV has unclean. But you see the cross that is in front of the word unclean? If you come over to the column outside, it says common. It has Greek common. So even the KJV 1611 knew that this was common, but put unclean in there anyway because did they have an agenda? That's a question. And eventually, the outside column there where you can have notes, we're here where it says Greek period common, eventually that goes away. So now the reader doesn't even have an opportunity to look at the language underneath the KJV 1611 English translation if that is gone. And of course, in later versions of the Bible, it is gone. So now a falsehood is being propagated. Yeah, that's a problem. We're going to go to the English Catholic version in 1861 by Rhymes. What do they have? Common, common, common. And I have another one here. Nothing is common of itself. But then if you look at the arrows, and you can see my red arrows there, it says common, that is unclean. It goes back to Mark 7, which once again is putting a statement of agenda in there that is not supported by the evidence, not supported by the facts. But let's keep going. Greek New Testament, 1966, second edition. Common, common, common. So I have a summary statement there. You can see where all of those pieces fall. And the evidence is clear. It was common. It was in the Greek common. It was in the Latin as common. And most of the Bibles prior to the KJV in 1611 translated it as common, Geneva being the exception, but that was corrected in the bishop that came right after it. They all had common. The Latin had common. The German had common. The Greek New Testament, 1966, still has common. They haven't replaced it yet. So all of them have common, but they're all being translated into English as unclean. And yet when you look at Leviticus 5:2 at Tami in the Hebrew and know that it occurs well over 200 times and not in a single instance is it translated into the Greek as common, that is a red flag. So as you can see, we can make our case that that is not supporting the Old Testament laws have been passed away. That's just skipping over the context so we don't even have to talk about it. So I'm going to go ahead and end this show here. And then we pick up the next show next week. We're going to come back to this point and continue moving forward. And then we will move to those other verses. Thank you.